Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Communities Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor today, Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn, New York. We have three very, very special guests today. First, we're going to talk to Mike Evans, and he's the co-director of a youth development program called Urban Roots. Then Judith McGeary, Executive Director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, will be talking with us about the USDA's National Animal Identification System and give us an update on that, and also some work that's being done on raw milk regulations in Texas. And finally, we're really excited to have farmer and sustainable agriculture champion Joel Salatin with us today to talk about the future of farmers and farming in America. So we're going to take a short break and be right back with our first guest, Mike Evans of Youth Launch. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and the show today is brought to you by Roberta's Pizza. I'd like to welcome Mike Evans to the show. Mike is the co-director of a program called Urban Roots, which is part of a larger nonprofit program called Youth Launch here in Texas. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marla. I'm glad to be here.
We would love to hear your, I'd like to hear the history of how did you start working with the program Urban Roots, and more importantly, how did the program itself come to be?
Yeah, so I co-founded the program with Max Elliott, and we both now co-direct the program. Max has been farming in Central Texas for about 10 years, and I've been here for about 6 years. And before I moved to Austin, I worked at a similar program called the Food Project in Boston, Massachusetts, bringing youth together, similar to how Urban Roots does it. And I moved here, and Max is working on various farms, and Max started working for Youth Launch doing a middle school gardening program. And he enjoyed the work that he did, but he wanted to be able to give young people a chance have a little more sense of ownership over the farm or the garden that they were working on. And so started thinking about changing the program to be a program where youth could actually work on a farm year-round or for a good chunk of the year. And he called me. We had connected earlier and talked about the possibility of doing something like this. And he said, I'm in the place to get something off the ground, and I'd love to partner with you. And so he and I started brainstorming, going around to different schools and conducting focus groups to see if our initial ideas about bringing youth together from different backgrounds to work on a farm as a paid internship, an educational internship, was something that resonated with young people. We employ youth ages 14 to 17. So the early part of high school, to see if that resonated with youth, and it did. And so we kept working on the details of the program, and now we employ high schoolers. This year we'll be expanding to work with 30 high schoolers, ages 14. Our second year youth are as old as 18, We work on 3.5 acres, and we've been working the past few years, and this year we'll be starting in February with them and working through July, and we do other off-the-farm leadership opportunities in the fall.
So when you started the program, how did you go about finding farmland for this?
Well, that was one of the biggest challenges, finding land that as a nonprofit we could lease for relatively inexpensive, relatively little amount of money, but also that had things like wells and had been farmed before. And so we went out sort of just talking to a number of people. We talked to the city of Austin about a few pieces of land, and it turned out that a piece of land that Max had worked on near 183 and Balm Road, previously had been called Oasis Gardens, was in new ownership. A woman by the name of Marisol was running Hands of the Earth Farm, but she wasn't farming on the whole land. So we had been working on this for a year and a half, and finally we connected with her, and it worked out really well. She is very open to having us there, very excited about having youth energy on the farm, and at that time really needed someone else to be farming part of the land. So it works out really well now because we farm till mid-late July, and then pass whatever's left. This last year we had okra still growing, some peppers, some basil. We passed that back to her, and she continued farming on that land. So in total, the area that we grow on is the farm as a whole, Hands of the Earth and Urban Roots, is 3.5 acres, and we had been farming about 1.5 acres of that. And it's been Urban Roots is really a community farming program and working in collaboration with a lot of people.
Tell us a little bit more about how that works. What do you say, you're a community and integrated into the community? How does that play out?
Part of what we do is we donate 40% of what we grow to hunger relief organizations. And at certain times of the year, our youth go and prepare or serve the food to people at those shelters or soup kitchens. We're donating to 7 different hunger relief organizations, so we have to partner with them. We sell at the Austin Farmers Market downtown that Sustainable Food Center runs, and at one of their WIC farm stands. We also have community lunches where chefs from local restaurants, this last past year it was Z Tejas, La Condesa, and Zoot, were all collaborating restaurants that the chef donated their time, something from their kitchen, took our youth to their kitchen, and prepared a meal for the community. So we're really trying to give young people lots of different opportunities to learn about themselves, to learn about food, growing food, but also preparing food. And that takes collaboration with a lot of different experts in the field, because we're certainly not experts in the cooking side of things. And it's proven to be a dynamic for the young people that they leave the program understanding where food comes from, how to grow it, but also about how to prepare new and different food in different ways. And they're understanding the networks that are created around Central Texas around food.
Well, and so when one of the youths, I know you haven't been doing this for too long, but when they leave the program, I think one of the really interesting things about your program, and it's a trademark of Youth Launch as well, your parent nonprofit, that it's a peer-driven program. And so talk a little bit about what that means.
So all of Youth Launch's programs empower young people by engaging them in service. And our other two programs, Train Up, our No Kidding and Youth Partnership for Change, train up the teenagers and young adults that work with us to go and give presentations to middle and high schoolers about the rights and responsibilities of being a parent and sort of educating and fighting underage drinking. Urban Roots does a lot of training on the farm to begin with for our high schoolers that work with us. And our high schoolers then, in turn, late in the spring and in the summer, are the people who lead our volunteer days. So they lead volunteers who come out to the farm, lots of times adults, and also lead our middle school field trips to the farm. So we're working on expanding our reach, but we want this program to be open to other people to come to the farm to get an idea of what an urban farm is is all about. And there's nothing like slightly older youth to be the role models that welcome them to the farm and give them a farm tour and let them know how they're serving the community and that it's possible for them, for the middle schoolers who are visiting, to do something similar, whether it's coming out to the farm to work or to volunteer or thinking about going to a hunger relief organization and volunteering at Caritas. So our young people directly interact with other young people on the farm and teach and educate them when they come to the farm. And then, as you were talking about, for many of them, they go off into something else. This is a 1 year or 6 month experience for them. And then they get a sense of community service and thinking about food and farming and go on to be connected to another job, apply for another job. Six of them apply and get hired back as level two interns, second level youth leaders, who then get more training in public speaking and leadership and will serve as leaders for our next group of young people that come in. We have three assistant crew leaders, three agriculture interns who will focus more on the production side, and all of them will learn more about creating an experience for the next round of youth, just as the previous year, our youth leaders helped make the experience for them.
That seems like a really great way to reinforce not only what they've learned by coming back and teaching it again, but also a way to establish an easy bond with the younger kids coming in. Did you model this program after other programs around the country? And you mentioned you've worked in Boston before, but are there other programs around the country that have been using this model?
So the Food Project in Boston has been doing this work for 19 or 20 years, and they're one of the leaders in youth development, sustainable agriculture. And there are a lot of programs throughout the country who do it slightly differently, taking that model or taking a slightly different model. So there's this sort of informal network. We get together sometimes at conferences and share curriculum and share ideas. Everyone's in every city is slightly different because of the transportation down in Texas, because of our seasons that we can grow year-round, but also the intensity of the summer heat. So there is a lot of sharing across these sister organizations. And a lot of times people have, depending on what region you're from, have borrowed from the Food Project or from programs in California. And it is really interesting to see all the different iterations that and ideas that people get, but they have to be modified differently. And different. When I was working in Boston, schools got out at 2:45, and youth could take the buses or subways to the farm and be there by 3:30. They could work for 2 hours and leave before the sunset. Here our schools usually get out around 4:20, 4:25. So we're doing a van pickup around Austin, trying to get youth to the farm to work for 2 hours before the sun sets. And so that's an interesting component that we're dealing with. But there is a lot of sharing nationally about different ideas about how to do youth and growing food. And Max and I are meeting with, in a few weeks, folks in New Orleans who are interested in getting an idea about how they could start their own version of this. So it's really exciting that these programs are continuing to pop up, and this is becoming more and more of a stronger national network.
That's very exciting. And do you think that in each case, or in your case, we can talk specifically, but how exactly does this work integrate into the school system and the curriculum? I know you said the kids are paid interns, but do they get credit for this in school, and how does it work with their school program?
That's a great question. Here in Austin, we've been trying to figure out if it can count for school credit. And with some schools, it can. For Garza, which is an alternative high school for 11th and 12th graders, it can fit into some of for a school credit. Some charter schools were working on making that happen. We haven't found that the way to do that with the Austin Independent School District. We're very interested in it. You know, it could be a paid program, but it could also, there are also other ways that youth can get credit for what they do. And I think in cities around the country, people are figuring that out, or they're able to work with their school systems because young people get a lot out of this program. Yes, for some of them, they come because it's a paycheck, and usually they stick around because it's more than that, because they're bonding with their peers, because they're connecting with the mission. But they're also gaining a lot of job skills and life skills. For a lot of them, this is their first paycheck, so they're getting we give them a money management class. We have a volunteer from a bank who comes in and talks to them about thinking about taxes, thinking about saving. So they're getting those skills. The public speaking skills, of course, they always talk about using in their classes, that presentations and classes are much easier. They're getting nutrition classes. So there's a lot that they're taking away in addition to the paycheck. But the paycheck allows, you know, it makes the program open to everyone, that youth who need an after-school job don't have to go, can't do our program because it's not paid. It is paid, so it's really open to just about everyone.
That's wonderful. I hadn't even thought of that as being a part of why the paid internship is so important, but that obviously really will make a difference in whether kids can participate or not.
Yeah.
What are some of your biggest challenges so far, and what are some of the things that you need?
Our biggest challenges, that's a great question. Every year, who knows? Farming, it's a lot of planning, and then it's a lot of luck and fortune. So some of the challenges every year have been certain bugs have attacked our plants. We've had certain illnesses. The heat this last year was very challenging with the drought.
I should mention, I'm just going to jump in for a minute,
yeah.
Mike. I want to mention that you have an all-organic farm. Is that right?
We do. We're not certified organic. We
right.
grow using sustainable and organic practices, but we're not certified.
So not
yet.
Certified, but
not
you're
using chemical.
Sustainable practices.
Exactly. We're not using chemical and synthetic pesticides. Exactly. So the challenges are the growing side of things. Also, we try to make our expectations with our young people very clear. So there's nothing that's going to jump out and surprise them. So from day one, we talk about what we expect at a job, and you know, showing up on time, wearing their work T-shirt, being respectful, working hard. We want to have those. The standard expectations out there, so they know what's expected. So it's not, you know, I'm not nagging them about you need to do this. I said, this is what we've established on day one, and you've signed on. You need to hold to your end of the agreement. Of course, that's
like a
hard.
Job.
every day, it gets hotter and hotter. It's hard to remember all these things, so we have to revisit those things. But it's a youth development program in that way. So right now we're recruiting for youth to participate in the program, and we're really trying to get a diversity in all senses of the word in terms of applicants. We're always in need of tools and seeds for our program. We just built a greenhouse, and so we'd love to connect some, instead of just using regular electric, we'd love to connect some solar. That's definitely on our wish list. We're also just started doing more outreach into schools. Mostly it's been farm-based education. We've done some presentations to schools, a local school, Ridgetop Elementary. We were part of their Family Health Night. We created a sort of PowerPoint game show called Veggies Make You Strong, where they have to match the fruit or vegetable to what the plant looks like before the fruit grows on it. And we have some educational, nutritional information about these vegetables. And whoever gets, we have three contestants, they write on a whiteboard, and they, you know, they can get help from the audience. If they get it right, they get a package of seeds. So we're also looking for seed donations for those, that sort of outreach that we're doing. And I'm sure as you're talking about, we're about to launch into Eat Local Week. So we're trying to get people to think about where their food comes from, to celebrate food in Central Texas that's grown locally, by getting restaurants to source one item locally. So we just ask listeners to think about where your food's coming from, and realize there's a story behind your food, and to go out if you live in Central Texas and support Eat Local Week.
Well, and that, you mentioned that. That's actually Edible Austin's signature fundraiser for the year, and Urban Roots is our beneficiary for this week-long celebration of local food and all kinds of fun activities going on throughout the week, and restaurants and markets participating as well. But in addition to that, and other, I know you're the beneficiary of many wonderful fundraisers throughout the year given and put on by many groups. And I know you get funding from grants and applications to community foundations and things like that. But can people donate directly to you, and what is your website?
That's great, Marla. Thanks for asking. Yes, we're a nonprofit, and we have gotten some generous grants recently, but we're still putting things together. As folks know, nonprofits need support to do financial support to do what we do. So our parent organization is Youth Launch, so our website is www.youthlaunch.org, and you can click on Urban Roots to learn more about the program, and there's a way to donate right on that top page to the program.
So if you live in the Austin area and want to volunteer, you can do that. Or if you live in the area or don't live in the area and want to just donate some funds, I'm sure they can put them to wonderful use. And
yes,
so go to Youth Launch. That's Youth, Y-O-U-T-H, Launch, L-A-U-N-C-H. I hope I spelled that right.
That's right, .org.
.org. And also you can go to edibleaustin.com for a list of all the activities, events, and participating restaurants and markets during Eat Local Week. So go to edibleaustin.com to find out more about that event. Thank you, Mike, so much for being on the show today with us.
My pleasure, Marla. Thanks so much.
This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. And the show today is brought to you by Roberta's Pizza at robertaspizza.com. Thanks for joining us. We'd like to welcome back Judith McGreery to our show. She founded Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance to advocate for independent farmers and ranchers, as well as for consumers who care about getting their food from local and diversified agricultural systems. FARFA is headquartered here in Austin, Texas, and has members now in at least, I think, 45 states or maybe even more. And they've recently taken on, actually it's been a continual lobbying effort now for a couple of years, I think, to try to lobby against the USDA's push for a mandatory national animal identification system. And so I'm very happy to have Judith back on our show. Welcome, Judith.
Thanks for inviting me on, Marla.
So there are two things I'd love us to cover, if you can cover for us. One is an update on NAIS, and also tell us a little bit about what's going on with raw milk regulations in Texas. But start with NAIS, if you would.
Okay. Well, the animal ID issue actually is now in its fourth year, as far as the work we've been doing, to try to stop it from becoming mandatory across the country. NAIS is a plan that would require electronic tagging and tracking of pretty much every livestock and poultry animal in the country. Things have been, well, they're up in the air right now. USDA held listening sessions around the country to get public input, and what they overwhelmingly heard at all of those meetings was that no one wants to have anything to do with NAIS except for, you know, big industrial ag folks. Congress drastically reduced the funding for the program in this coming year, and, you know, all signs should be that the program should just go away. Nobody wants it except big ag. there isn't the money to fund it. It should simply disappear. We're getting some hints, unfortunately, that USDA is going to be a bit stubborn about that potentially, and it's up in the air, and we're waiting to see what they do next.
Well, and just to follow up on some of the arguments about what's problematic about this program, besides the fact that it's very onerous to smaller, especially small family farms and smaller operators and producers, but they try to sell it as a food safety issue. And is there really anything to do with food safety involved with this?
That is, the food safety argument is completely baseless, and they should be ashamed of making it, frankly. The vast majority of food safety problems with our animal products, what meat, eggs, things like that, are processing issues. So when you hear about E. coli recalls, salmonella recalls, the hamburger meat being pulled off the shelves, that's because of something that happened at the slaughterhouse or sort of during food processing and handling after the slaughterhouse. The National Animal ID System tracks an animal from birth to death. So it stops right when the vast majority of the food safety issues start. So it does nothing to prevent food safety, food contamination, and it does nothing to help with the trace back of contaminated foods. It's irrelevant to food safety, frankly.
Well, at this point, as you said, things are a little up in the air. Is the best thing just to stay in touch with your website, join your group so that you can get updates so that you know what to do when we have opportunities to?
Absolutely. And it always helps, of course, when people actually join and become members. But, folks can even just sign up for free email alerts. And we don't share or sell our email list to anybody. So you can go to our website and sign up for free email alerts. And we're thinking, again, sort of it's up in the air, but it looks like things are going to be happening before the end of the year. So, in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Well, and tell our listeners, if you would, what your website address is.
Thank you. It's www.farmandranchfreedom.org. That's farmandranchfreedom.org.
Great. Well, another issue, Judith, that you're working on right now that I know is near and dear to our hearts here at Edible Austin, and we have an article coming out in our next issue about it, in fact, is the regulations of raw milk. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on here in Texas with this?
Texas has, to be honest, one of the somewhat better laws in the country. It's not great, which is why we're working on it, but it does allow for sales of raw milk. The farmer has to be licensed under grade A restrictions. And in order to get licensed, they have to go through a lot of building a milk barn and meeting all these sanitation requirements and testing. It's a very extensive regulatory framework. And then at the end of the day, once they've met all these requirements, the real problem begins because the regulations restrict the sale of the milk to on the farm. And, here in Texas, a dairy farm is very frequently an hour, 2 hours, even 3 hours away from major population centers. So it's a real problem for a farmer who wants to be grade A licensed to try to figure out how he's going to do it and make that investment and then tell all of his potential customers they have to drive to the farm. And it's a problem for the customers who may not have the time, the gas money, the ability to drive 2 or 3 hours each way, a round trip of 4 to 6 hours every week to pick up fresh milk.
Well, and it's a lousy thing for the carbon footprint, too.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about this in terms of energy usage, it's appalling. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, unfortunately, but we actually had some engineers do a carbon footprint analysis of the situation. And the numbers were pretty impressive. We're talking about a massive use of resources that's completely artificially created by these regulations.
So, again, with what's going on right now, we've had an opportunity, I understand, to have our say, so to speak, in front of the council that regulates these, that's in charge of these regulations and regulatory laws. And are we hoping, what outcome are we hoping for?
We're hoping for them to start moving on a change in the regulations. And believe me, this is an incredibly frustrating thing that I want to prepare people for. It's a slow process. Nothing moves fast in an agency. You know, we just need to recognize that fact. And we, as you said, we got our say. The council, which is the decision makers for the Department of State Health Services, seemed very sympathetic to what they had to say, to what we had to say, sorry. Many of them recognized this is an issue of, you know, what makes sense from an environmental perspective, what makes sense from a consumer choice perspective. You know, we're not asking for anything radical. We're asking for a farmer to be able to sell directly to a consumer, you know, a product that they that the consumer wants.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is agency staff is a little more leery of it, and so we're going to have to keep pushing them if we want to see this change happen.
So, again, there's no issue about any of the regulatory rules up to the sale of the milk. It's just being able to have access to grade A licensed milk that's been inspected, but to be able to have that milk brought to either a milk drop location or the farmer's market as a place to be able to buy, again, directly from the farmer.
Absolutely. One of the people who spoke actually at the meeting in front of the council made a wonderful point. He said, you know, he spends every Sunday, he devotes his entire day to driving out to a farm, picking up the milk, coming back. It's 6-7 hours out of his Sunday every week. When he goes to the farmer's market the day before on Saturday, his farmer is there selling pasteurized milk.
Huh.
Same person selling to the, you know, same people at the farmer's market. The only difference is that they've put up this marketing barrier to raw milk.
Well, and we haven't even gotten into the why raw milk question, which we don't have time on this show, but I'm going to have you back because this is such an interesting subject. And, again, you'll be able to – our listeners can read about it in Edible Austin, the winter issue coming up that talks about the why raw milk is worth doing all of this work for. And also, if you don't subscribe to Edible Austin, then you can also find our article online starting in the early part of December. But, Judith, thank you so much. Again, farmandranchfreedom.org is where you can go to get updates on raw milk and NAIS and also join and help the cause.
Thank you so much, Marla.
Lots of land and the starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please. Don't fence me in. Don't fence me in. Just turn me. Let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies. On my kites, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences. Gaze at the moon until I lose my senses. I can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in. Don't fence me in. Let me straddle my own side.
took a soda cracker. Does your mama chew tobacco? If your mama chews tobacco, Booker took a soda cracker. Green rocky road, promenade green. Tell me who your love, tell me who your
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn, New York. I'd like to welcome our next guest, Joel Salatin. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It's great to be with you.
Thank you so much. Joel Salatin, for those who may not know, is the owner of Polyface Farms in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, and he's been called the High Priest of the Pasture by the New York Times. He and his farm have been extensively profiled, including one of my favorite parts of Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and in the documentary Food Films, Food Inc., and most recently, Fresh. He's also the author of many books on farming and on his philosophy about farming. So, Joel, I'm going to start off by just asking you, what do you think is the current state of farming here in America, and how do you fit into this picture?
That's a great question, Marla. Well, I think the current state of farming in the U.S. Is that we have a tremendous interest among eaters for a relationship with food, for integrity food, local food, transparent food systems. And so, you know, we have a proliferation of farmers markets. We have more and more very, very small farmers, niche-type farmers, specialty product-type farmers. That's a burgeoning, branch of farming. And that's exciting. But at the same time, we have the backlash from the, you know, industrial food sector that is not very happy about losing market share to small, local, transparent operators.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fascinating that all of these, movement creates movement, and every time one sector moves, then there's a balancing over on another sector.
So how do you see this? Obviously this is a huge challenge right now for those of us who are championing the smaller and sustainable farming operations. So tell us a little bit about the history of your farm and what you're doing and what you're doing now, especially.
Sure. Yeah, well, we've been here now almost 50 years, and we run livestock on pasture, and so that means we're moving them every day. We run pastured broilers, that's meat chickens, pastured layers, that's, of course, egg-laying chickens, and then we have pigs and cows, beef and rabbit and turkey. So all of those go on pasture, and because they're moved every day, all the infrastructure is portable as well. So we've got, skid A-frames, tall tunnel hoop house type structures. So there's all sorts of portable infrastructure, portable fencing, and paddocks that are moved around with this kind of choreography that we move them all around every day.
So that's the basis of your business. One of the other things you've been doing quite a lot of, besides being showcased in other people's work, is that you're starting to do a lot more appearances yourself and also writing introductions and forewords for other people's books right now. So you seem to be emerging as quite a strong spokesperson for this new focus on local, organic, and pastured.
Sure. I say that the biggest tragedy is that apparently we're so abnormal. What we want is for us to be more normal. But yeah, you're right. I mean, being the prominent position that we had in Omnivore's Dilemma, and then now these two new ones, Food Inc. and Fresh, both feature us as well. And I do a lot of speaking, and here we are. I'm thankful for my old high school and college debate and theatrical background, and so it's just a real fun thing for me to be able to combine my forensic performance persona along with my real calloused hands, dirt under the fingernails farming persona. It's kind of a cool wedding.
Well, and you've been quite an inspiration for a lot of people, so I think it's a very valuable role that you're playing right now for us. In fact, we're going to have you here in Austin. We're very excited. On December 5th, you're coming for our Eat Local Week, week-long fundraiser and awareness raiser for local food. And we're going to have a community screening of Fresh, the movie, and also have the director of that film, Anna Sophia Joannis, here with you. And we're really looking forward to this because we'll have a Q&A panel. We have a reception before the film. Lots of opportunities for people to meet you. And
I'm looking forward to it as well.
Great.
It'll be a great time.
One of the things that we were just talking to our last guest about on the show is raw milk. And you did just write the foreword for a new book called The Raw Milk Revolution by David Gumpert.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about why your interest is going in this direction now and what's so important about raw milk and our access to it?
Well, it's simply the point, the tip of the spear, if you will, right now. It's the current hot button for what I mentioned, the backlash from the industrial food system, which is trying to demonize, marginalize, or criminalize indigenous heritage-based system. They're using words, for example, like Tyson, concentration camp chicken houses are science-based. And so our production, where we actually have chickens running around in the grass in the pasture and commiserating with red-winged blackbirds, then the red-winged blackbirds can take our diseases to the science-based Tyson chicken houses and threaten the entire world's food supply. And so this is the kind of paranoia and data, science, whatever, clever speak, that's coming out of the industrial food system. And so the whole milk thing is a part of that, in that, it's safe. It's safe food to feed your children Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, and Mountain Dew. But boy, that compost-grown tomato and raw milk, now that just might kill you. And so what's happening is that everything that our 3 trillion member internal community knew about for thousands and thousands of years, that you could actually pronounce and make in your kitchen, those kinds of foods are being disparaged by the industrial food system, and what's being touted is fortified with this and red dye 29 and preserved with this and augmented with that, and we've got all sorts of things that you can't pronounce and can't make in your kitchen. So the whole raw milk issue ultimately comes down, like all of these issues come down to, who will you trust with your food supply, and who ultimately has the authority to make the choice of what to feed our 3 trillion member internal community?
Well, and the other aspect I think that's important is that we perhaps could benefit from a more local focus on where we buy our products from. It would eliminate the necessity for a lot of these preservatives and other ways of making sort of abnormal long-distance travel possible. And so perhaps with that local focus and working out relationships with farmers in your area, you can also bypass a lot of that.
There's the first step in any business accountability or any relational accountability is integrity. And you establish integrity by having a transparent relationship. And you go to the average industrial food, whether it's a farmer or a processing plant or anything, and you can't get a tour. You can't get in there. From trade secrets to paranoia of bringing in disease or whatever. And so the local food system is the quintessential antidote for the current the veil of opaqueness that currently disconnects everybody from their food system and allows a lack of accountability and therefore corner cutting on all sorts of levels, economic, social, nutritional, environmental, corner cutting from the food system. And so a local connection like that, a local relationship, is the antidote for all the things that people are paranoid about right now. The antidote is not going to come with more legislation and more regulation from inside the Washington Beltway. It's going to come with people, making their own choices and having the freedom to make their own choice on their food.
And having access to it, too.
Yes. Yes, well, that goes hand in hand. I mean, the fact that you can't sell raw milk in half of the states, and even the ones that you can, it's still, it's limited by number or advertising or some sort of stipulation. The point is that the reason that we don't have a more viable local food system is because of the heavy-handed, capricious regulations that are not scalable to small scale. They've been written for large-scale industrial outfits, and so they don't scale to small operations. The amount of paperwork, we now co-own a small federal inspected abattoir 30 miles away where we get our hogs and cattle slaughtered, and we get exactly the same sheaf of new regulations and paperwork to fill out every week as a plant that does, we do 10 head a week as a plant that does 5,000 a day. It's exactly the same paperwork. So, obviously, the price prejudice against the small-scale operation is enormous when you don't have scalable regulations.
Right. Well, and that's something that needs to be tackled on many levels, not just definitely a consumer level. With the one thing that people can do is to make it very clear what they want, and they can make that desire clear to their legislators as well as lobbying groups that will help with that, like the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance that we just were talking with.
Sure.
And also just the idea that we do need to have some of these regulations changed, whether they be local, state, or federal.
Sure. Yeah. And another thing that people, when people ask, what's the ultimate independent thing that I can do, I tell them the first thing you can do is find your kitchen. Get raw food, get unprocessed food. You don't have to get all this processed stuff. Get it directly from a farmer, a farmer's market, a CSA, a roadside stand, a farmer that you know, and patronize that farmer and get it raw and cook it and mince it and puree it and dice it and all the things that processing does to it. Do that in your own kitchen right at cooking time, and all the nutrition will be in it instead of out of it.
Right, that's a really good point. Joel, you've written a number of books. One of my favorites is Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. But
right.
One of my other favorites, and I was just rereading it, is Family Friendly Farming. And I think it's a wonderful book because it really puts so much of the emphasis on our values and what we value in life, and how farming and family farming in particular can really help and reinforce that. So can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to write that book?
Well, all of my books have been written as a result of questions people ask, kind of the current hot button that's touching people when they want to know about things. And so Family Friendly Farming was written as our children, came of age as late teens, and we were all working together here and getting along well and doing, how do you do that? I can't get my child to even help me, weed a row of green beans or pick peppers or whatever. How do you get your kids to work with you? And so it was written out of a yearning to touch other families with some of the principles that business principles, working together principles, child relationship principles that we're not perfect, but we've done a few things right, and I just wanted to share those. But the other thing too is that it articulates the real values in life. You know, there's not a millionaire that's gone through, you know, three divorces building his millionaire empire that would trade it all in the quiet of the evening, actually, or in the twilight of his life, would trade it all for the honor and respect of his kids and his spouse. Same thing would be for women. The point being that the things that we really value in life, all of us, they never make the balance sheet. They never make the business plan, including things beyond that. Like, have you ever gone into a bank with a business plan and the banker looks at it and the first question is, now how does this affect the fertility of frogs in your ecosystem, or how does this affect the salamanders? How does this affect your marriage? We all intuitively understand that the most valuable things in life are not the empirical hard stuff that we put on business plans, balance sheets, and tax reports. And so this book addresses those values and it tries to explain how we can have a multi-generational family business without forfeiting those things that in our heart of hearts we really know are most valuable.
Well, and so I can recommend that anybody listening to this, please go check out all of Joel Salatin's books, but Family Friendly Farming is one in particular that I think is very inspirational. And Joel, in talking about inspiration, what would you like to tell us about the potential future for making progress in all these areas? And also, you've touched on what we can do individually, but what would you like to see happen in the next, 5 to 10 years?
Oh, that's a great question. What I would like to see happen is a two-pronged approach. I meet farmers every day that are struggling. They're good farmers, but they're not good marketers. And what I want to see are some eaters who maybe have some storytelling, a little bit of a schmoozer, gregarious schmoozer storyteller skills, to come alongside, and so that these farmers can grow the business, so they can actually hire a couple people, and as they age, they'll have young energy. I want to see farms that have a median age of that organization of being, 35 years old. I don't want to see all these farms that have, 60-year-old people on them and no young people. I want to see young people in farming. I want to see all of the, I want to see the farmland that's going to waste. There is so much land just growing up and going to waste around the country that's been abandoned in this great cycle of the aging farmer. See that go back into production. I want to see lawns. I want to see edible landscapes. Colleges and universities should go from inedible landscapes to edible landscapes, so the students, can graze pears and apples and strawberries between classes. I mean, why put all these chemicals and stuff on just lawn and inedible ornamental stuff? Why not grow edible things and turn this into productive land? America has 35 million acres of lawn. That's a lot of food. And then so that's a production end. And then on the other end, I want to see millions of Americans rediscover their kitchen, sit down and have a family meal together instead of just popping boxes in a microwave, and enjoying the cultural heritage and just all of the integrity of social, familial, ecological, economic, community integrity that comes when you actually sit down to a meal that you've had a relationship with, that where you've had some courtship and romance, before this intimate experience. So it's not just a prostitution one night stand deal, and that will touch people on such deep levels that we'll have this wonderful synergy then between these really excellent producers and these very knowledgeable artisanal eaters who come together and change our heal our country one bite at a time.
Well, thank you so much, Joel, for that. That is very inspirational, and food can truly bring us back together as a society, as you say. And we're really looking forward to having you here in Austin, and anywhere else you go, I would encourage people to try to go see you, read your books, and support all these things that you have been inspiring us about.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, thanks again today to our guests. We also thank you for listening to our Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Roberta's Pizza, in Brooklyn, New York. And I'll be back in 3 weeks on December 21st. But tune in next Monday and every Monday for the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network.